There are many kinds of museums. From the supersized Smithsonian to the childhood home of Muhammad Ali, from Bangkok to Boston, and everywhere in between. But museum goers only see part of the full picture. On this show, we open the crates, tell the stories, meet the people, and reveal the inner workings, unseen, unheard, until now. From Philbrook Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is Museum Confidential. Marks the 60th anniversary of New York's Solomon R. Guggenheim Museum. The Guggenheim was the final and perhaps crowning achievement of legendary architect Frank Lloyd Wright. This is also the 60th anniversary of Wright's death. The museum opened in October 1959. Wright had died 6 months earlier. All these decades later, Wright remains a complicated figure. We recently sat down with acclaimed author and longtime Washington Post reporter Paul Hendrickson to chat about his polarizing and somewhat kaleidoscopic new biography of Wright, Plagued by Fire. Taking on a project like this is no small feat, and I know that many years went into it, and that's no different than the previous books you've tackled. How do you know when something is going to be worth the time? Because you don't know as a journalist that it's going to bear the fruit that you're going to see through doing all the research. You say, I'm going to devote this much of my time. Is there a probationary period that you give yourself to maybe abandon a project if you start kind of going down a certain road?
What a fabulous question. Yes, and no, no. If I can just pick up a few of those answers. They do seem to take me the mystical, magical 7 years. The previous book, Hemingway's Boat, took 7 years. I had worked on a book about Vietnam and Robert McNamara over a period of 12 years, because I gave it up at one point and crawled back to the Washington Post to kind of reclaim my family's broken finances, wrote another book in between, finally came back to it. On the probationary period, one box opens another box. You don't know what you're getting into. It is a leap of faith. On this particular book, because I'm not young, I had finished Hemingway's Boat, published in 2011, which was not a cradle-to-grave biography of Ernest Hemingway. Too many of those had been done. And I like this one on Wright, I don't think my psychic power is invested in those. You could say I don't know how to do those. I wanted to show the arc of his life and look at storytelling pockets. But specifically to answer your question, I gave myself a probationary 2-year period. My agent, after Hemingway's Boat, which I immodestly say was successful, but the humility part of that, I mean, successful commercially and critically, the humility part of that was the first book I've written of a number of books that was both commercially and critically successful. Maybe I should have stopped there, but there was something in me that wanted to keep trying to go forward. I gave myself from 2011, when Hemingway's Boat was published, to 2013. So that's 2 years of investigation, wandering around the country on my own, trying to determine what these storytelling pockets might be. While my agent would have happily said, let's sign a contract while the getting's good with Knopf, my longtime publisher, I wanted to wait and see if I had the energy, if the story was there, and I felt that it was. So in 2013, I sat down and wrote a proposal. And this book has just been published in the fall of 2019 and on October 1st. So 7 years have gone by, really 8, depending on how you count. They take forever.
Is there a moment when you're giving yourself that discovery period and you're thinking about whether or not you want to fully engage with this material? Is there an aha moment when you say, I think I've tapped into my angle, I guess, for lack of a better word?
I heard a writer say once, and I'm not quoting it precisely right, that what he was trying to do was go to where the silences are and say something different, say something new. A couple of those aha moments for me were in this ocean of material that has already been written about Frank Lloyd Wright, depending on how you count, 8 or 9 thoroughgoing biographies ahead of me. One of the aha moments was that in this century and more, nothing had really been written about a man named Julian Carleton, who was at the heart of an iconic, disastrous, horrific event in Frank Lloyd Wright's life. Mainly, Julian Carleton, a black domestic servant, on August 15th, 1914, instead of ladling out the soup for lunch, goes inexplicably berserk and kills with a shingling hatchet 7 of 9 people in the house, Wright not being there that day, and then roasts the place to cinders. And this is at Taliesin in Spring Green, Wisconsin, the place where Wright lived longer. He built this place, his house. It's been built and rebuilt and rebuilt again because it has suffered more than one fire. But the point I'm trying to get to is this century and more, the man at the heart of that day, that person, Julian Carleton, whom history said was 31 years old. I found out that he was closer to 26, never weighed more than 135 pounds in his life. Who was he? We had him as a kind of cartoon of madness. That's all. He was a cipher in history. I was determined to try to find out something about him. If you Google the name, the words Julian Carleton right now, right today, it'll come up in the first or second line that he was from Barbados. He was from somewhere in the West Indies. No, he was from our own country. He was from Alabama, from a backwoods Alabama family whose parents were born into slavery. That was one of my aha moments when I went in search of Julian Carleton and found out certain things about his life. So many things are unknown and remain unknown. That was an aha moment that, hey, maybe I can contribute something to this project that hasn't been looked at before. There was an old, great sports editor at the Washington Post named Shirley Povich. I didn't work for him, but I knew him well. He worked at the Washington Post for 75 years, and he was basically retired by the time I got there, and I worked there for 23 years. He used to tell his troops, if you go, it'll happen. So I went. I went looking for Julian Carleton, and that was among the places and pockets that I thought, I might be able to bring something to this story that other people haven't.
What do you think about preconceived notions about Frank Lloyd Wright specifically, meaning when you came to this project? Now, you're from a part of the world where there's a big amount of Frank Lloyd Wright work. I guess Chicago is the kind of, you know,
that's ground zero.
Spiritual home. Yeah, everything is there. Ground zero is a great way to put it. We think of this megalomaniacal person wearing a cape who ran this group of, you know, underlings with an iron fist. We think, you know, all these things, but also the genius and all those things. What are we trying to counter with this book? And what are we trying to reveal with this book?
He is all that. He is every bit of that egotistical, narcissistic image. We don't have that wrong about him. He does strut through the world in a 72-year career as an architect and an egotist with those goofy pants, almost pantaloons, pegged at the ankles. And this, on his tallest day in life, even with his 1.5-inch stacked heels, he was never more than 5'8". You know why his ceilings are so low? Because he was so small. He was building them, in a sense, to his egotistical scale. All that stuff is not wrong. And I do not wish to try to sound grandiose, that I have a higher vision, a keener vision than other people. But from the first, I had this intuitive feeling that maybe there was something under all that dross and refuse of ego. How did I arrive at that? What am I talking about here? Maybe the H word for his humanity? Maybe it came to me in several ways. For one thing, I wondered whether and how anyone could survive this horrific event that I was just describing to you and go on indeed for another 4.5 decades and create monumental pieces that we know of today, like the Guggenheim, for instance. All that came in decades following the wake of this disaster. How could you even live, let alone have a career. That interested me about him. And I thought, gee, you must have to have a kind of humanity and vulnerability that the world doesn't quite know about. I wanted to explore that. Also, I grew up in Kankakee, Illinois. There were two Frank Lloyd Wright houses on the same street that I lived on. We were five blocks north where the commoners live, but down at the river were these immense houses, and one of them is in every Frank Lloyd Wright book. It's a seminal house, 1900. It's the forerunner of all his prairie houses. I used to study that house on my J.C. Higgins three-speed on my way to the ballpark with my Spalding ball glove hooked onto my handlebars. I would look over at it. And it scared me. It beckoned me. It vaguely repelled me. I think something else. I'm a slow learner, Jeff. It only took 6.5 decades for it to loop around and find me as a writing project. But I think one of the things that was happening to me even then was this. What kind of soulfulness do you have to create something like this? So I felt that
Was there an awareness, though, when you were a kid thinking about that home? That this was something of note, meaning was it talked about? How would it have even come to your awareness? You know, this had to be something that people, by that time, he was, of course.
And this is in the 50s. You know, this is only a few years from his death. He's worldwide famous.
Yeah. So, I mean, the idea that, you know, the most famous architect in the world built two houses, you know, in your neighborhood, this had to just be kind of part of the general
neighborhood zeitgeist. Yes, except a little parochial altar boy, Paul, who's 9 years old. I'm not sure I even knew the name Frank Lloyd Wright, but something about the house itself. When I saw that house, it's called the B. Harley Bradley House. Any book, any Google information about Wright will have something about the B. Harley Bradley because it's the St. John the Baptist house. It's the precursor to all the great prairie periods of the first decade of the 1900s. When I first saw that house, I was just overcome by the differentness of it. It was as if it came down from Mars. And you're right. Other people all around must have known about him. And not me. I was looking at it just as this strange object. When I first saw it in 1953, it had ceased being a residence. It was a glittering restaurant, the most glittering restaurant in our little downstate Rust Belt town. It was called Yesteryear, and rich people dined behind those art glass windows with real cloth napkins and candlelight. Our middle-class family could never afford that. But he infected my consciousness as a 9-year-old is all I can say, and it took all these years to find him. And when I started out to find him, I thought, well, is he just this rank, insufferable, egotist, or is there something more? How do you create something? And then how do you create something that beautiful and not have some fundamental decency? You know, here's a quick fact about Frank Lloyd Wright. Of all these buildings, you know, he designed 1,100 things and about 500 and some were built and about 400 and some still stand. The overwhelming majority of them are houses. They are shelters for mankind. And I wonder if by that fact alone, we might slyly start to think of him through a slightly softer lens. He wanted to build residences that might be here long after he was not here.
What you're getting at is interesting to me in the sense of you mentioned the word humanity, and you don't mean that, I would suspect, in the sense of the way a university might think of it. You mean it in the sense of empathy.
His ability to feel, to hurt, to suffer.
Do you think that someone capable of creating true beauty can also be devoid of humanity?
That is the old artist's question. Can great art, I start with an epigraph from the great critic of the 19th century, the hero of mine, of the 20th century, I mean, Malcolm Cowley, who says that, you know, he thinks it's impossible that true scoundrels can ever create great art. But it's a complex question. We need to separate the art from the artist. I get that. My friend Sally Mann, the photographer, said you shouldn't judge the art for the artist. The two are correlated, but in very complex, difficult, ambiguous ways. But I believe that a true out-and-out bad person cannot create great art. Frank Sinatra, horrible human being to so many degrees, but not all the way. And look at the artwork. Ernest Hemingway. I know something about Ernest Hemingway. Spent 7 years on him. We think of him as this braggart, insufferable, paranoid, had to destroy everyone in sight. Yes, yes, and no. Once you start looking at the letters. Once I started looking at Frank Lloyd Wright's letters and reading stuff that was there in plain sight on the page and in other ways more hidden. And one of the places best to find the humanity, not the kind that you'll find in the academic departments at the University of Tulsa, the humanity of empathy, as you said, good word. Every Sunday morning, Frank Lloyd Wright, he was a preacher's son. He comes, preachers march all the way back in his family history on both sides. He would give these spontaneous, unscripted, off-the-cuff fellowship talks to his
apprentices,
the fellows. They were such eye-openers for me. Once I started reading the transcripts, and once I went to Columbia Avery and was able to get hold of certain audio transcripts of them, the longing for his father, for instance. His father hasn't come up in this podcast yet. His father, about whom he told the greatest single lie of his life. What's under those remarks? You begin to see that longing, that humanity, questioning all kinds of things. So I began to feel his three-dimensionality.
That's when he started to seem like a real person and not a picture in a book, someone who was on some Mount Rushmore of architecture. I'm not even a Mount Rushmore. I guess he would be the only face on it probably for the 20th century.
And how about a note of humility here? Did I succeed? Critics out there are telling me, a lot of them, that I did not succeed, that I too much played up the graphic, sensational, horrid, gothic aspects of his life, of which there is too much to be counted. If I did that and made any of it lurid for lurid's sake, then I surely failed. It was not my intention whatsoever just to go to this horrific event on August 15th, 1914. Rather than telling a reader, Frank Lloyd Wright suffered a horrific event on August 15th, 1914. He wasn't there. His mistress got her head split open and seven people died. Rather than saying that in a paragraph, I said, I want to make the reader feel what that incident was like and how could, my motivation was to suggest, how can someone come back from that? That's what I was trying to do. And I think some have understood it wholly and others absolutely have not. And on that, I will say, I had my say. The world is rightly having its.
Today's episode of Museum Confidential is sponsored by Historic Homes. Time moves on. People pass away, even the very wealthy, despite advancements in cryogenic technology. And those big fancy houses can't just sit there. How about a museum? The Frick, the Getty, Philbrook. It just makes sense at some level. So pull out that pen, Daddy Warbucks, and amend your will. Tell them to make it a museum. Don't just live somewhere historic, do something historic.
When you're finished with a project like this, after having spent so much time, that you've led me to an interesting point here. What is your own metric for whether you've succeeded or not? Because we can't leave it up to critics. As we know, time plays a factor in it. 5, 10 years, 20 years from now, the book may be seen differently based on myriad factors. But when you, whatever, you know, write the last word, submit it, however you want to see the kind of end product, how do you make a judgment for yourself in
thank
terms
you
of quality?
Thank you for asking me questions that have been kind of haunting my waking dreams. I've questioned myself so much this fall. Did I write a bad book and not even know it? I think I did not. Would my editor of 40 years, parentheses here, in book publishing, that never happens. Book publishing is a revolving door. I've been with the same man over 40 years. I've been married 41, and I've been, so I'm a bigamist. I have a book editor. We've been together 40 years. Would he have let me publish a bad book? He puts on his editor's hat. He can be ruthless. He can be so tough. His name is Jonathan Siegel. He is a vice president and a senior editor at Knopf. And yet, so people who get the book and critics who have reviewed it grandly are stacked against so many who did not and others who have attacked it. And so I find myself retreating and questioning what I did. The answer, I think, is it's too soon for me to know. My nose is too pressed up against the glass because it's up one day and neck down the next. The up-downness, up-downness. This is not my first rodeo. We went to lunch today and I said, you know, I've been writing books 40 years and I was a journalist all those years at the Washington Post. Not my first rodeo, but in a sense, I have been kind of emotionally on the ropes. I will say, a good writer friend of mine in Dallas, he said, what can I say? We were talking about this the other night, and he said, what can I say to you, Paul, about discouragement? He said, well, one thing is discouragement, after a while, passes off, and then you get a sense of yourself back and your power back. You know, reviews are evanescent, and as you said a minute ago, sitting on a shelf 5 years, 10 years from now, it's every, well, history is replete with works that have a different life a little bit down the road. I am not unhappy with the life that this book is having at the moment. First of all, I'm profoundly grateful to have done it. I'm profoundly grateful to be here.
Don't you think that indifference is worse than perceived initial negativity? Meaning,
a strong
reaction to me is far more interesting than eh. And there's not a lot of eh.
No, in this book, there's not a lot of eh. Would I rather it have be The Irishman, Scorsese's new film, in which everybody seems to be jumping over themselves about these three lead characters? Yeah, of course, who wouldn't? But the indifference thing, or not getting reviewed at all, or yeah, inflaming emotions for or against is not entirely a bad thing.
Yeah, I think when I look back at the films and the books and the works of art that I love, and you go to the origin point for these pieces, very few of them are universally lauded from day one. And I think a lot of times it takes us a little bit of time to understand what we're dealing with. I'd like to finish with a couple of questions on the tone and voice of the book, because I think that plays such a big thing. And over the time you've been writing books, it seems to me, having read your work, that you have been honing in on how to actually write like yourself. And I think this book is the one that is maybe the clearest distillation of you. And I think that may be tied in with some of this conversation about why it did or did not succeed.
What have I aimed toward? To sound more and more like myself in the way that I would be having this conversation right now, and to find a way to put that on the printed page in as best journalism-literary tone as I can muster, but still have it be a conversation in a sense with the reader. I've had so many students of mine, I teach writing workshops at UPenn, they say, Prof, I'm reading the book, it sounds, that's what they call me, said, it sounds just like you talk in the classroom. I take that as a compliment. I can see that rubbing people the wrong way.
Yeah.
I'm not doing, the tone of it is jolting to some people.
It's written more in the voice and tone of those new journalists, like the Hunter Thompsons and the Didions of the world, than it is in a scholarly biographical treatment.
In which you might say, on every other page, I'm spying in on myself. I'm talking to myself and questioning myself, and metaphysical things arise. And my older son, who is less, he's literary, but it's my younger son who's very journalistic literary. My older son says, oh, Dad, so many detours. He was talking about in the Hemingway book, he faithfully reads all my books, and he said, when are we going to get to the gun? When are we going to get to the gun at the end of the book? I said, well, I know the gun is coming. You know, when Hemingway, need to say this soberly and sadly, when Hemingway destroys himself, just blows his head away in a tight little space. And Matt, our older son, knew all that. But he said, Dad, when are we going to get to the gun? Oh, no. Oh, no. Here's another detour. Oh, no. Here's another tangent. But it sounds just like you, Dad. It sounds like what you would do. I guess I'm willing to take this risk to try to sound like myself, to be authentic on the page to the voice that's inside my head.
I think when we get to the place in our lives when we look back and think about how we got here, wherever we end up, it's the detours and digressions that we remember most. So I think the history will be kind to this. But thank you for taking some time to talk to us today.
I have loved this more than I thought I would.
So long, Frank Lloyd Wright. I can't believe your song is gone so soon. I barely learned the tune so soon, so soon.
The most famous song on the 1970s Simon & Garfunkel album Bridge Over Troubled Water is inarguably the title track. But perhaps the most curious track is So Long, Frank Lloyd Wright. This was the final studio album by the famously quarrelsome duo. Written by Simon, it's generally seen as being less about Frank Lloyd Wright than it is about the upcoming breakup of the group. Garfunkel had studied to be an architect. The connection didn't dawn on Garfunkel at the time, and he didn't seem to realize he was singing So Long to himself. Years later, in an interview, he said that Simon never let me in on that secret. He added that, I find that a secretive and unpleasant thing to have done to you.
That's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. To learn more about what's going on at the museum and at the station, visit philbrook.org or publicradiotulsa.org, or both. We suggest both. Until next time, look closer.